Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. An injured truck driver grappling with opioid dependency. A grandmother appalled by her grandson's white nationalist beliefs. A mother who takes in the child of undocumented immigrants while grieving a daughter murdered by an undocumented immigrant. His approach is not without its critics, but throughout his career, Washington Post reporter Terrence McCoy has sought to tell the story of each of these Americans. Lives, struggles, and joys that help define our daily life, but often get little attention. This hour, On Point, in depth on Terrence McCoy's America. Join us. What issues do you think are overlooked by the mainstream media? What stories have changed the way you look at your neighbors, your communities, your nation? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Later this hour, we'll speak with a winner of this year's Pulitzer Prize for International Reporting. A bit later this segment, we'll talk a little bit with one of the women who was a key figure in Terrence McCoy's article. Joining us from Washington, D.C., as promised, Terrence McCoy. Terry is a reporter for The Washington Post. He writes about social issues across America. Before joining The Post in 2014, he was a reporter for the Miami New Times, an alternative magazine there, and a newspaper there, and volunteered with the Peace Corps in Cambodia. Yesterday, the Columbia School of Journalism announced the winners of this year's Pulitzer Prizes. But last week, Columbia awarded Terry with the 2019 Meyer Mike Berger Award for, quote, an outstanding example of in-depth human interest reporting. That's a quieter award for quieter stories, but of no less interest. Terry, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me, David. I appreciate it.
So I think you've described publicly your approach as thinking big but writing small. Tell me what you mean.
Well, right now, we are in the midst of any number of giant social issues that are roiling the country. And you think about the most combustible issues right now, race, guns, gender relations. These are massive stories and massive issues. And sometimes it's difficult to think about, like, how can I render and create a story out of something so big? So usually what I try to think about is I think big about this big, massive issue and then try to write small and try to write about one person facing one certain situation that will resolve itself. And then through analysis of that person's story, you're able to understand this much bigger idea, this much bigger America.
So let's take the second reading we laid out for you. You introduce the question of dealing with opioid pain. There's a guy named Kenyon Stewart in Colville, Washington. He's one American suffering from chronic pain, and his life has been overturned following a new set of guidelines issued from the Center for Disease Control and Prevention on how much painkillers, how much OxyContin, right, that he can receive. Why don't you share that passage with our listeners?
So the story begins like this. The morning of the long drive, a drive he took every month now, Kenyon Stewart rose from the living room recliner and winced in pain. He looked outside at the valley stretching below his trailer and again wondered whether it was getting time to end it. He believed living was a choice, and this was how he considered making his. A trip to the gun store, a purchase of a Glock 9mm, an answer to a problem that didn't seem to have one. Stewart is 49 years old. He has long silver hair and an eighth grade education. For the past 4 years, he has taken large amounts of prescription opioids ever since a surgery to replace his left hip, ruined by decades of trucking, left him with nerve damage. In the time since, his life buckled. First, he lost his job. Then his house, forcing a move across the state to this trailer park. Then began a monthly drive of 367 miles back to his old pain clinic for an opiate prescription that no doctor nearby would write.
Terry McCoy, what was the genesis of this story?
So I did a year-long series on disability in rural America in 2017. And what I found in a lot of these communities was that there are a lot of opioids. A lot of people were struggling with opiate addiction, which is something that, you know, was kind of known. People understood that. But what I also found was that more and more people were saying that, you know, although there's a lot of opioids here, it's getting really difficult for me to get my prescriptions and I have this disability. And what I recognized in that moment was that the narrative of the opioid crisis, one of just wanton prescriptions, one of just everybody being able to get any pill they want, that was no longer the reality in a lot of places in America. The reality was that there are a lot of people dealing with a lot of disability issues and also a lot of addictions, but weren't getting the same number of pills they used to be able to, which was creating this terrible reckoning in their personal lives and in their communities. And what this also created was that people were going to extraordinary lengths to be able to try and find a doctor who would still write them the prescriptions, because so many doctors across America were terrified that they continued writing prescriptions the way they once had, that they're going to end up in the slammer. So what this meant was that people were driving or flying extraordinary distances every single month just to be able to maintain their old pain pill regimen. And what this led to was, you know, me calling as many people going through these certain circumstances to see who I could go with as they make this long drive.
There's so much reporting embedded in this. You tell this as, you know, we call it in journalism a narrative, right? It's a story, although we don't use that word to try to diminish the fact that these are real lives of real people and you know, real pain and real struggles. At the same time, you've embedded so much factual reporting in this that kind of breezes by you. It doesn't overwhelm. It makes sense. But you know, this is easily a story that could have been written as a policy story, right, on the front of the national section, and said, you know, there's concern now among advocates for the people who are addicted to opioids about the fact that scaling back this drug, while needed, is, you know, causing them incredible withdrawal, incredible pain, depression, you know, suicidal thoughts, and the like. You wrote this very much as a human story, far away from, you know, the CDC, far away from DC, far away from so-called experts.
Well, that's because that's how it affects most people. Most people don't these big policy stories, the way that affects people's lives are in personal and intimate and familial ways. And those are the stories that I'm interested to understand and to know, is that how are these big massive issues are happening in America? How is it affecting someone in the most personal and intimate of fashions? And with this story, I mean, that was a conversation. Is this a story that's more of a policy first story? Is this a story that's a human story? And what I tried to do, and what I try to do in all my stories, is you try to marry these two things together. You try to blend them together so that that it becomes a narrative, it becomes a story you don't want to put down. But at the same time, you're able to learn so much about whatever the issue is, and you kind of blend those two things together. Sometimes I think about the classic structure is that somebody just does the narrative and then they go back to the policy, then they do the narrative and then go to the policy. And sometimes readers just kind of breeze past the policy to get back to the story. So if you can just kind of put them all together in one cohesive narrative, then you can get people through to the finish.
I got to say, you're a gorgeous writer. You and I have never spoken before. I have not really read your stuff before. You'd never know that this was the point of this is, as you titled the piece, you know, Unintended Consequences. And yet it's really about a very human struggle there. I want to talk to you about the struggle within another family. It's a piece about Cam Musser and his mother, Kirsten. Cam is withdrawing more and more into himself, and he's basically – it's the story of a young neo-Nazi revealing his true self to his family. We have a reading there, and I'd like you to share that with listeners.
Okay. This moment is when the mother of Cam was for the first time looking up the group that he had joined and what that meant. And so it begins with, who was he becoming? What was this group doing to him? Was it a cult? She couldn't put it off any longer. She had to know. She reached for her phone. She plugged in the name that for so long she had tried to ignore. Traditionalist Worker Party. Said Wikipedia, neo-Nazi, white nationalist group. Said the Southern Poverty Law Center, advocates for racially pure nations and communities and blames Jews for many of the world's problems. Said a party tenet, citizenship in the ethnostate must therefore be limited to white persons and white persons alone. She shook her head, sighed, looked at her son, put down the phone. It makes my stomach hurt, she said. What, he asked, the reading? The description, she said. She felt a sadness come over her and a sense of shame that she that her son was so dedicated to a cause she not only found repugnant and was certain would never yield anything, but seemed so distant from who he was. She knew him, and there wasn't hatred there. The words on the screen, that wasn't her Cam. This had to be a phase. It just had to be.
You present what the hatefulness that this young man's association, you know, the traditionalist worker party represents. You represent all of that, and yet you represent him as a real human being here. You're not depicting him simply through the eyes of his critics by a long shot. What is it like to spend that much time, as I believe you did, with somebody who, you know, represents so empirically hateful views?
It was weird, but also, you know, fascinating and important. And the point of this story.
Yeah, well, tell me why fascinating and why important.
Because when you're spending so much time with somebody who has come to believe these things that are so far out of the norm and so far out of you know how most Americans feel, thankfully, you really have to resist the urge to argue with them and to say, well, no, that's not, you know, this isn't. But at the same time, I wanted to really know who he was and why he believed this way, and I was there to listen, and I wanted to hear how he got to be the person who he was, and I also wanted to hear how his family felt about this.
Mm-hmm.
So I would just write down and things that he would say, and oftentimes he'd say, you know, something outrageous, and he'd ask, you know, well, what do you think about that? You know, and my job as a journalist is, you know, I want to be as objective as I possibly can be, and I would just say, you know, it's very interesting to hear you talk about this. I'm interested also to hear what your mother has to say about this, because he knew and I knew that his mother and his grandmother were fierce opponents of everything they had to say, and this created in his own household this collision between the familial and the ideological of a young boy, really 21 years old, who is coming to learn who he was, confronting his mother, who was a lifelong liberal, and his grandmother, who was even more liberal than she was.
Mm-hmm.
And what this has done to his family and kind of rendered it and splintered it in so many ways. So just to be able to be inside this sort of ecosystem that explains so much about America, you could just see it was a fascinating circumstances.
We're discussing the work and the view of America of the prize-winning Washington Post reporter Terrence McCoury. I'm here with Terry McCoy. He's asking you to join our conversation. What struggles do you think define America today? What overlooked stories do you think define your communities? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. I'm talking to Terry McCoy. He's an award-winning reporter for The Washington Post who looks at America through the question of smaller stories to tell big narratives about our nation. You can join the conversation. What social issues do you see in your communities not reflected in the media? Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. We're starting to have some comments on the website. AC writes that he or she was in Baltimore last fall, was appalled by homelessness, and lately back in Boston is seeing it picking up here, or maybe my eyes are now opened. A listener named Sam Winston, or posting under that name, writes that blaming drug use and drug users is a great excuse for poverty, but I know plenty more functional addicts than I do burnouts. It's a stigmatization of people who are drug users. The real problem is a question of access of to money and services. That simply being judgmental about poor people with no systemic out in a system that is not giving them a way in is wrong and unfair. Terry McCoy, I want to turn back to your reporting about this young neo-Nazi, in part because, of course, the issue has really come to the fore. There's been a rise in extreme right-wing activism in recent years, during the Obama years, certainly under President Trump. We, of course, don't have to think much farther than Charlottesville to have evidence of that. What kind of reporting did it take? What kind of immersion did it take in this family to yield you know, this incredible kind of back and forth dialogue and the insights that you had. Three generations. I mean, you spent time with the son who is becoming increasingly radicalized and racialized, his mother who was in some ways giving up hope, and his grandmother who tried to do an intervention when she felt that the mother was unable to do it herself.
It took weeks. It took weeks of going back and forth to Columbus in Ohio to be able to really get to that point where I had the rapport that I needed to be able to get to those very intimate and personal scenes where they trusted me and they didn't mind that I was there and that I was, you know, a quiet observer bearing witness to what their lives were in that moment. And it also just takes an enormous amount of empathy, I think, for people going through something extraordinary. Many of the people I write about never thought that they would be in a newspaper, don't think that their stories are even that important. They're oftentimes surprised that I'm there for so long. And they don't really – one of the most common things people say is like, well, it's going to be pretty boring if you want to come by and hang out with me. It's going to be – it's going to be boring. I'm like, no, I'm sure I'll be fine. And – so but what it is it's creating this sort of sense of trust between me as a writer and also them as the source that I'm going to tell their story accurately and with empathy and also just do whatever they're going through, do justice and do an important story about this.
Did you witness every exchange that you represent as dialogue?
Yes. Yes, I was there for everything.
It's like a screenplay. I mean, it's really intense. It's really intense and it's really painful, I got to say.
You know,
you want the kid to kind of be open to listening. There's a reveal that you have, and forgive me if you don't want there to be a spoiler wrote about the story, but he goes to the young man goes to the lunch that he's having with his grandmother, and she's so impressed with the beautiful cashmere sweater he's wearing. And then at a certain point, he stands up, and as she's talking, he takes off his sweater, and what does he reveal underneath?
That he's wearing a white nationalist t-shirt. And this is the moment that we're out at this restaurant and she'd been thinking about for months, this grandmother, how she's going to confront this boy who no longer seemed to be the boy that she knew growing up. Where was this Cam that she once knew? And she takes him out there and she says, this just isn't who you are, Cam. This isn't you. And he stands up and he takes off this sweatshirt that she had just complimented, that she adored, that made him look like the boy that she once knew. And underneath it was this white nationalist t-shirt. And he sits down and there's this moment of silence. Neither really talks too much. And she just looks at him and she says, I just don't know how he got this way. And this back and forth going on about her saying, but, you know, we have friends who are black. What about them? And he's getting angrier and angrier to the point where they just stop talking. And she says, but if I tell you that I won't ever talk to you again if you continue on this group, what will you do? And he says, I would leave the group, but I wouldn't abandon my beliefs. And what is there really to say to that? So this very tender and intimate moment ends in this sort of there's this frustrating, incomplete conclusion to it. Mm-hmm. And a lot of these stories end that way, where it's not quite perfect at the end. A lot of times it ends unresolved in some way. But they each went back to their houses knowing that they had found at least an answer to something, that he was true to his beliefs and she wasn't going to get him back, and at least not in that way.
We've got some calls coming in, some suggestions I'm imagining. We've got a call from Mike calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Mike, go ahead.
Hi, how you doing? I was very intrigued by how you think the family is splintered. Do you feel that there's like a lack of, personal communication in families, you know, especially now in our digital age with, everybody, on their computers or on their phones? And then, you add to that all the information or misinformation that's out on social media that inflames people, that, is there for a purpose. I mean, did you find that as part of, existing in part of your research?
Yeah, no, Mike, thanks for the question. That's a great question. What I found was that a lot of this radicalization that Cam went through was through the internet. And on Facebook, what was once believed the most benign of social media was really an ecosystem for people to come and believe these things. And I also found an extraordinary hesitance and reticence in the family to discuss these very difficult issues. What was at stake was the family itself. And when a conversation or an answer to a question you have to ask could result in the splintering or rupturing of your family. It's a question that, you know, mothers and parents want to avoid and don't want to talk about. They want to watch TV. They want to, you know, focus on something else. They don't want to have that terrible conversation with their boy because they're worried about what they're going to find out. And this is something that happened day in and day out in this family, was this difficult conversation that never was happening.
I think it was in thank you for that call, Mike. I think it was in your story, Terry, in which you talked about a white nationalist, essentially a white supremacist, a racist, who was a young, roughly the same age as the young man you were writing about, who said, yeah, you know, I've got a fake Instagram account so I can fake out my parents basically. But yeah, I'm a total racist.
Yeah, exactly. So it's a lot of – I talked to a number of kids really. Many of them were very, very young. It was actually – one of the most surprising things I found was how young some of these people were, 16, 15, 14 years old. And they would lead these double lives where they would be one thing on the internet and another thing back in their home. Mm-hmm. And so there's these families across America and really across you know, the Western world of that – they were one thing in their family unit, but there's something else completely online. So there's many families who had no idea that their kid believed this stuff or were saying this stuff online. But there were also these moments, like what I found here in this family, was that it was coming out for these people and revealing really who they were to their families and what that resulted in.
I'd like to take a couple more calls now. We've got Linda calling from Colton, New York. Linda, thanks for listening. Thanks for calling.
Well, thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
What I was wondering, if you are seeing any tie-ins, really, from kids that are joining these groups or feeding into the opioid addiction, looking at the generational poor or the working poor in the sense of learned helplessness that they see, and then seeing no way out and no reflection and understanding from the society that they're in, does that play into any of these things that you're finding?
I know with a number – and thank you for the call. I appreciate that. And I know that a number of – with the white nationalist groups, a major thing that they do target is lower-income whites. And there is – because there is across America low-income whites – are going many of them are going through a very difficult time when as the economy changes and transitions into a thought economy and all these mines and factories close has left a number of white men without work, without as much opportunity. And what this has done is it's created a recruitment ground for a lot of recruiters to go in there and give folks someone to blame. And I do know that the Traditionalist Worker Party, before it imploded, really did target working class, low income whites, and they even were planning trips into Appalachia to be able to talk to poor people and be able to be somebody to go and they're going to give out food, they're going to give out sweatshirts, and also just give them out a dose of what their twisted ideology was. And this is something that was a big driver in sort of recruitment.
I want to take a couple other calls. A number of people are suggesting stories. They're answering your clarion call, Terry. We've got Sarai is calling from Baltimore, Maryland. Thanks for calling in, Sarai.
Hello.
Hi.
So I've heard a lot of talk about national issues, international issues in reporting, but what hits closest to home to me is domestic violence. You know, I saw the rise of the Me Too movement, and I think it's great. I'm glad that those sexual assault victims are getting a voice, and I'm really proud of them for standing up. But I'm a domestic violence survivor, and having been strangled in front of my kids by my ex, and when I went out and I looked into the media and I looked into it, A, nobody wanted to cover the story, and nobody's talking about it. It doesn't seem like it's cool, it's sexy, that it's interesting, and yet so many of us women, and there were so many men who survived these personal assaults in what should be the safest place for us, and just nobody cares. I had the judge tell me that not only did he not really care, but didn't believe that it had happened during the divorce proceedings because the state's attorney, and this is a quote from the state's attorney, said, "We don't believe you were strangled enough to go after a disabled veteran in this political climate." So they just bargained away whatever I had because they didn't want to pay the money to put him in jail because he's a disabled American. He lost his leg in Iraq. And then the judge didn't believe me because the prosecutor wouldn't go after him.
Sarai, thank you for that, sharing that. It sounds like a heartbreaking account of what occurred. How would you, Terry McCoy, how would you approach looking at whether it's Sarai's story or maybe it's a story that you don't know? You say to yourself, you know, I need to shine a light on domestic violence. How would you go about trying to get the kind of immersion that you need to tell the kind of story that you seek to tell?
Well, I totally agree that the country is facing a crisis in domestic violence, and far too many women are trapped in terrible circumstances and don't know how to get out. And I think that in itself, being able to talk to a woman who it's so difficult to know where you're going to go and what you're going to do, and being able to talk to a woman who's facing circumstances like that and trying to plot out and trying to figure out how she's going to get out, if she wants to get out even, because that's sometimes a question that people have to face too, where they say, is this something people have to – all these calculations that someone has to make when they're trying to rebuild their life or start something new. But I think that's definitely a worthwhile area of coverage and a story that we should do.
Let's turn now to a story that really did make national headlines. One of the things that's interesting about what you do is it seems to me you go sort of to the story after it's been in the Klieg lights and in the flare, and where there's 1,000 reporters there, and you go when there's almost nobody there. You did a story about a family where a young woman was killed by a person who was in this country without legal status, person who was in this country illegally, and you ended up doing a story about her mother, about Laura Calderwood. And there's a passage that I want you to read where you're illustrating a moment about how Laura Calderwood decides to take the son of undocumented immigrants into her own home.
Okay. Laura hated the sound. And this is something where Donald Trump had just talked about her daughter, Molly Tibbetts. And she says, Laura hated the sound of Molly's name coming from his mouth. His words were the opposite of who Molly was, advancing a cause she vehemently opposed, as her father, Rob Tibbetts, who separated from Laura, wrote in a newspaper column soon after her funeral. She'd wanted to welcome all immigrants who needed help. So when Scott, her son, soon came to Laura with an unusual request, could they take Ulysses in, she asked what had happened. The nation, it seemed, was directing its anger about Molly's death toward Yerby Farms, where her alleged killer had worked, deluging it with vitriolic messages. The immigrant families who worked there were fleeing. Laura thought of Molly. She would argue that the farm workers didn't deserve this, that they were only trying to earn a living. What would she say about Ulysses? Bring him in? Laura thought that his father may be undocumented and worried about attracting unwanted attention. But again, what would Molly say?
We have with us on the line from Iowa, Laura Calderwood herself, whose daughter Molly Tibbetts was allegedly killed by an undocumented immigrant and who went through the national attention and all that Klieg lights. Laura Calderwood, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Good to hear your voice, Terry.
Hi, Laura.
Sounds like you're still on speaking terms. Laura, what was it like to have Terry approach you? What pitch did he make after you had had so much media attention, you know, in the nation's leading news organizations, really focusing so much attention on the fate of your daughter and then of her death as a political issue? What pitch did he make that made you say, yeah, I'm going to welcome this guy into my home?
That's a real simple question. Terry had sent me, I think he sent me a FedEx, he sent me several means of communication, but then my niece came into work and said, Aunt Laura, there's this guy from the Washington Post that's really trying to get a hold of you. And I was like, and anybody who knows me, the first thing I read in the morning is the Washington Post. And I was like, oh, yeah, I guess I better call him back. So, and that just kind of went from there.
The persistence paid. What was
the persistence paid? Absolutely, that's one of my favorite phrases.
Laura, what was he able to accomplish in this piece that made you appreciate what he did? It sounds like there's a real rapport between the two of you.
There is a real rapport, and you know what Terry did, because after Molly's passing, I received all kinds of, Terry saw it, mail from all over the country. Just the letters, not the other forms of communications and the gifts. And but I'm sorry, I just got distracted. Terry.
No, we know we're talking to you at work, but I'm just sort of – we've got, you know, a minute left before the end of this little segment. We're hoping you can stick with us even though you're at work. you know, what I guess what I'm asking is, what was he able to accomplish? What was distinctive about this piece of reporting on you, your family,
what
and your tragedy?
What was distinctive is that when after Terry wrote the article, I got a lot of more communication and letters, one of them being from Bill Clinton, who read that article and sent me a handwritten message saying, this is the kind of news that this country needs right now. That's what Terry did. I got a letter from Bill Clinton.
And Terry McCoy, briefly before we just end this part of the segment, what was it about Laura Calderwood that struck you once you had finished the story and done your reporting?
I mean, Laura has an incredible story. And the fact was that Laura, the conventional way that these sort of situations are presented is the fact that somebody loses their child in these circumstances and they turn against undocumented workers in the country. But Laura, it was never going to be that person. She never abandoned her beliefs. She stayed true to who she was, and that's what made her remarkable.
Well, we're going to thank you. We're going to relinquish you at this moment, Laura Calderwood. We know your work. We appreciate your taking time out of your day to share your story about the story. Thank you so much, Laura Calderwood.
Okay, thank you for having me.
And we're talking to Terrence McCoy, the social issues reporter for The Washington Post. He'll stay with us. We want you to stay with us. We're discussing America through the eyes of this award-winning reporter. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik, and I'm talking to Terrence McCoy. He's social issues reporter for The Washington Post. He looks at the nation through a very distinctive prism, as he talked about earlier. He thinks big, and he writes small. Your approach humanizes people. Your approach helps us understand them. Your approach helps us treat them as people we might see as in our own communities and our worlds. And yet there are moments at which your approach sometimes engenders some controversy, some criticism. Last July, Terry McCoy covered the story of two white employees at a Bell & Evans poultry processing facility, if I remember it right. They found themselves in the distinct racial minority as they labored side by side with an overwhelmingly immigrant and Latino workforce. And the article received I think it's fair to say incredibly strong pushback, particularly from Latino journalists who criticized the framing of the piece. Here's Julio Ricardo Valera. He's founder of the media company Latino Rebels, speaking to NPR's Here and Now about his reservations.
I think you could speak to anxiety and still tell a full story, because the biggest problem with I have with this piece, it really never humanized the Latino workers. So my thing is, the anxiety is there, and the Latino workers, mostly Dominican and Puerto Ricans, are seen as sort of these zombies.
And Valera was not alone in this criticism. The National Association of Hispanic Journalists, took it up with your boss, Marty Baron, the executive editor of The Washington Post, and others weighed in, including a few with affiliations with The Washington Post. Talk to me about what you were trying to do there, Terry McCoy, and tell me what you make of the critique.
With these types of stories, I think as journalists, we're oftentimes drawn to more of the untold story. And the story of immigrants coming to this country and working in food processing plants is a story that should be told and has been told. What we're experiencing right now in America is a lot of tumult racially over immigration and over this sort of demographically changing country. And at the heart of this is this anxiety that Donald Trump is tapping into over these sort of demographic changes. And you can make the case that the most resonant narrative that Donald Trump has is one of immigration and one of demographic change and one of inciting fear over this change. And I wanted to do a story that isolated in a very crystalline way this anxiety. So I went to a chicken plant and wrote about two workers who were one of the only few workers inside this chicken plant that didn't speak Spanish, but were nonetheless in a community that was 95% white outside of the chicken plant and 95% Latino inside of the chicken plant. So this is a unique circumstance, and they're experiencing in a particularly intense fashion What this anxiety that has become so politicized in the country. This is an important issue to understand and to know in all of its complexities, and this is an important perspective to filter it through.
Did it strike you that in retrospect, hey, it might have been good to sort of have complementary halves, the yin and the yang, do one sort of in crystalline fashion, as you say, about what it's like to for whites who have the expectation of being in some ways ethnically dominant in this country or in their community, their county, having that ratio inverted on them. And then looking at it from the other side, you mentioned in passing one of their colleagues who kind of surprisingly agreed that perhaps she should learn English, but that she hadn't been able to. She was caring for her mother who was ailing. She was making a 45-minute commute. It was doing everything she could to get to work and take care of her family obligations, and learning English just wasn't in the cards. Or do you think that that's sort of a false pressure to always tell the story of those who have experienced, in their case, certain kinds of discrimination since coming to this country?
I think it's complicated. I think these issues are really complicated. And I think especially my goal is oftentimes to write about the most controversial issues in America at any moment, the things that people care most passionately about. And when you're writing about these issues, it's difficult and it's complicated to, you know, find always the perfect balance. And but with this story set out to look at a perspective that had not been told before, the perspective of the whites inside a chicken plant who do not speak Spanish and what their life is like. That's a story that had never been told. And the story also married that with the perspectives of Latinos inside the chicken plant. But it really focused on those whites and what their lives were. And I think it is possible in journalism to write about immigration but not write about immigrants. You can write about immigration as an issue, but it doesn't always need to be through the perspective of immigrants. And this is a story that achieved that.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier in the show you like to not to you want to be objective. Do you nonetheless have judgments? I mean, do you have reactions like all of us who are reading your pieces, or are you able to somehow push that to the side as you're doing this?
Oh, I really try to push it to the side. I never set out with any story to write with any agenda or anything like that. I think that would taint a story. Really, what I'm looking to do is just be a window pane into someone's world, just a clear window pane, and just get out of the way and let the person tell their own story. And what that does then is it both also shows this person who they are, but also doesn't lionize them. I don't want to have overly sympathetic portraits of people either. I just want to show them who they really are. And a lot of times people get scared, you know, when I'm writing about this or when I'm first meeting them, and I just tell them, listen, this story is not going to – it's not going to make you a hero and it's not going to make you a villain. It's just going to show you and all the complexity of who you are.
Before we wrap up our conversation with Terry McCoy, I want to take a last call from Sojourner. She's calling from New Orleans, Louisiana. Sojourner, thanks for calling in.
Thank you for having me. Mm-hmm. I'm calling because I've been listening intently, and I have a personal experience. But the thing about it is that I'm surprised when I hear these conversations about how white America is so taken aback by the issues that are happening in this country. As a minority myself, I experience them constantly. On Mardi Gras Day, as an example, I'm coming downstairs with my 2-year-old. He's on my hip, and I slip on the fourth step of 14 steps, and we tumble down. Mm. I go to the hospital immediately, within 20 minutes, getting myself and my husband and everybody together to get him out because he can't stand. Mm-hmm. We get to a hospital, and I'm asked 7 different times by 7 different people what happened. Mm. And it couldn't possibly be that we fell down the stairs together and that I'm also injured, but they say, oh, he has a broken leg and the injuries couldn't be as a result of your story.
I see.
In turn, they call Child Protective Services and we get transported to Children's Hospital, who then, and the difference, I'll explain the difference between the two hospitals. I get to Children's Hospital. They're like, this is just a fracture. Mm-hmm. There's no need for any other things, but he has a cast and he should be out of it in 2 weeks, in which he was. Mm-hmm. But as a result, I'm still dealing with the fact that Child Protective Services has now been called. Mm. And when I get to talk to these people, they come to interview me in my home where I'm working on a PhD. My husband's working on a PhD. We live in a very nice, affluent neighborhood. Not that.
And Sojourner, I've just got a bit of time before the end of this segment. But that's, I think Sojourner raises an interesting question for reporters, too. In the last minute that we have, how do you make sure that people's stories are believed, and how do you make sure that people's stories are proved?
I think she touched on so many important points when she just called here. And I think one of the most important things she talked about was the fact that we as journalists also need to be telling stories of minority communities and how they are dealing with living. I think there's so many the anxieties and that people are experiencing right now in America are diffuse, and we need to be able to tap and write about all of those with equal measure and equal sympathy.
Human concerns, human anxieties writ large, and also in distinctive ways for distinctive people. We've been talking with the award-winning reporter for The Washington Post, Terry McCoy. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
In a moment, we'll be talking with one of this year's Pulitzer Prize winners, a member of the team reporting on the war in Yemen. I'm David Folkenflik. This is On Point. Yesterday, the 2019 Pulitzer Prizes were announced. The winners included the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette for its coverage of the Tree of Life shootings. The Advocate of Baton Rouge, Louisiana, was honored for its expose of Louisiana's jury system. And a team of reporters from the Associated Press was recognized for its coverage of Yemen's civil war. Maggie Michel is part of that reporting team. She joins us now from Cairo. Congratulations, Maggie.
Hi. Thanks, David. Thank you.
I appreciate your joining us. This was an important story. We wanted to talk to you for two reasons, one of which is it's a story that in some ways is undercovered, and it's undercovered in many ways because, as I understand it, it's an extremely dangerous story to cover. Yemen, of course, a country of about, call it 27 million folks. It's on the, I guess, the heel of the boot of, that is the Arabian Peninsula. Tell us what's happening in Yemen now and why it's been important for you and your colleagues to cover it.
Since 2015, the war in Yemen turned into a regional battleground between Saudis and those who are supposed to be backed by the Iranians. There are many wars in Yemen. There is a war between rebels who are preparing the Sana'a, the capital, occupying it with fear and with weapons. And there is the United Arab Emirates that's almost occupying the southern part of the country. And there are the Saudis who are very worried about their borders, and they have been leading the air campaign to destroy much of the country, kill civilians, and turn it many parts to displaced camps. For many reasons, this war did not attract attention. It has been forgotten. There is always this perception that it's only the Saudis to blame. And when you visit Yemen and speak to people, there are many players and many parties who are to blame and should be held accountable. And one of them is the Houthis, who are occupying the capital. There are the Emiratis, who are in the south. There are many players that should be held accountable. And this is why we went to find out what's really happening there.
It's also been, you say many players. It seems like there are also almost like in the Cold War days, there are a lot of patrons of some of the players. The Saudis seem to be involved. The Iranians seem to maybe have a hand in it. If I'm not mistaken, in recent years, America has conducted drone strikes there or at least supported Saudi strikes there. There's been a lot of interplay, right?
Yeah. America now has two major battles. One is against the Houthis in support of the Saudis, and they're supplying them with weapons, many rights groups, and we also tracked these weapons, and most of them are American, French, British supplied arms that have caused massive destruction and civilian casualties. At the same time, U.S. continued its very long campaign against terrorism, using drone strikes against what it described as the AQEP, Al-Qaeda, in the Arabian Peninsula. However, we investigated the latest series of attacks and airstrikes and drone strikes, and we found that at least a third of them did not kill militants. Instead, they were either civilians or fighters working and fighting with the government. And this is one of the issues that the U.S. never recognized and never admit, that it's actually killing civilians through the drones.
I just want to underscore that for listeners so that they heard it. You investigated and found that a third of those strikes conducted by Americans didn't kill civilians. The troops they were saying that they were going after. They were either killing civilians or some of allied troops that are in a sense aiding the side that the Americans are trying to help, and that you also investigated the flow of weapons. That's right. That is that if it had not been for the Associated Press's reporting, we would not, as the public, know what was being done there by Americans, by those allied with Americans, or by other Western powers. Is that correct?
Yes. I mean, one of our investigations also found that the U.S.-backed coalition has struck deals with the AQAP militants where they gave the militants safe passage to withdraw from the cities they were occupying in return for incentives, including arms, including cash. And also, what was really striking is that we found that the Emiratis and the Saudis were using AQEP in the war against the Houthis. And indirectly, U.S. is enabling the coalition to help AQEP to continue to pose a threat not only to the U.S. but also to Yemen.
And tell me, what is it that made it particularly dangerous to do reporting there? I was told that you and one of your colleagues at various points were pulled out.
Since we have been working on covering Yemen since the war started in 2015, we saw that somehow the coverage has been only looking at the Saudi side of the story. Also, if you see after Khashoggi, the Saudi journalist's death, there is momentum against the war. However, there are many other issues that need to be told. There are many stories that need to be written about, and one of them is how the children, for example, are being used as a fuel for the war.
The children are being used as fuel. Are you saying they're being used as shields? Or are they being used as troops?
As fighters. Mm-hmm. We met children who were recruited. They were like 10, 11, 12, 13. They were being taught how to hate the West and hate America, hate Israel. They were being told that this is your enemy, the enemy of God. And then they were sent to the front lines. Where they are killed in dozens, and nobody is reporting about it. We can only in the media see that Saudi-led coalition bombed a bus with children and killing them. But we don't see the other side, where the Houthis are also using them to fight the coalition. It's also very important to say here that the Saudis are also using children on the other side.
So children warriors found on both sides of this conflict, so ably and importantly covered by Maggie Michel, the correspondent for the Associated Press, and her team from Yemen at quite some risk. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You can join our conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Our show is produced by Anna Bauman, Madeline D'Angelo, Brian Hardzinski, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Allison Poli, Tanya Rally, James Ross, and Alex Schroeder, with help from Matt Hoisch, Alex Pina, and Sydney Wertheim. Our executive producer, Karen Schiffman. Me, I'm David Folkenflik, and this show is On Point.